Our last case this morning is 824-0565, the State of Minnesota versus, I hope I pronounced this correctly, Joshua Bulow. As all parties are aware, counsel for the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Counsel for respondent will have 15 minutes, and then finally, counsel for the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Whenever you're ready, just approach the microphone and tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul Maravilli. I represent the appellant in this case. His name is pronounced Joshua Bulow. This appeal raises three issues challenging the second degree assault convictions. The first, the primary issue, is that key evidence on the level of harm was admitted erroneously as a hearsay exception, where the state never established the required foundation for business records exception, but that this also violated Mr. Bulow's confrontation right. Secondly, that the evidence for substantial bodily harm on the top count was insufficient. And finally, that both second degree assault convictions must be reversed due to the admission by the district court of unfairly, harmfully prejudicial evidence from a squad video filled with irrelevant and inflammatory character evidence relating to Mr. Bulow. In the hearsay and confrontation issue, I should note that the proper challenge was made, contrary to respondents' assertions about whether the records were compiled correctly and accurately. That was done at page 248 of the transcript. And it was challenged as well, properly objected to, for any hearsay exception. The one the district court chose was the business records exception. Now, to perhaps cut to the chase here, there may well have been a witness that the state could have called to establish the needed criteria for a business records exception, most notably that this witness should have knowledge, at least in how the records were compiled, the conditions. The witness the state called was a records release supervisor.
Let's say we agree with you. What was the harm?
Well, this particular evidence, I need to offer a little more context then, if I may. To me, the most disturbing aspect of this was that the Friday before this trial started on a Monday, the state withdrew the doctor who prepared the report from their witness list. And defense counsel was appropriately surprised by that and made the objection. The harm is the significance of this report. If you look at the direct, and cross-examination of the victim in this case, KK, the prosecutor had to concede during his direct that you could barely see any evidence of the cut to his nose. During the prosecutor's closing argument, the prosecutor didn't focus on the cut to the nose. He instead focused on these supposed fracture and deviated septum that Dr. English wrote in her report may have been old, both of them.
But wasn't defense also allowed to provide an additional page from the medical record showing that the fracture may have been old?
See, Your Honor, I think that goes to, if I'm going out on an improper limb here, then so be it. But for the prosecutor to pull the doctor from the witness list at the last second strikes me as an unfair litigation tactic. It is one thing for a jury to see a report where the doctor is, I guess the word is, considering the possibility that the injuries predate the incident, but without the ability to cross-examine, to establish through the doctor, and have time to prepare it, to establish with the doctor her expertise in dealing with injuries. She didn't really put in there why she thought it was old. Cross-examination could have elicited her reasoning, her basis for putting that information in the report. With the state getting in just a paper document the defense was effectively deprived of any ability to cross-examine this information. And the state was free to argue that it talked about a fracture in a deviated septum that he still insisted was attributable to this incident. So the harm is the significance of the evidence in order to obtain the substantial bodily harm conviction and the inability to cross-examine it. Added to that is the fact that the prosecutor mentioned this evidence repeatedly from opening through his case and in closing argument. This element of the degree of harm was everything. And the fact is, up until the Friday before trial, the one witness that would have been both necessary for him to prove the element and give the defendant his fair chance to challenge it was pulled from the witness list. I mean, this obviously had nothing to do with the doctor. It was the prosecutor's call. So the witness that was called, I mean, I hope I've answered your question. I was just going to fill in a few more details about the lack of qualifications.
I just don't understand how that would have affected the verdict, because in this case you have Kingbird, who actually testifies and says, I had all these stitches. I don't remember how many there were, but how would it have changed the verdict when you have the person testifying and saying, yeah, I had these stitches, he did it, that's what happened.
Judge, any laceration, a doctor is going to say you should get stitches for that. That doesn't, I mean, based on how that view of the record is taken, then any cut is substantial bodily harm, and that's simply not true. I'm relying on the published case of Harlan that talked about permanently visible scars. I think the only case cited in response here was Webster, a non-precedential precedential case, which had a one-inch scar on the forehead that was still visible. The degree of harm has to have been temporary but substantial disfigurement. And I think the prosecutor himself...
One of the deputies, there was some loose skin, or one of the deputies talked about a knife wound that left a piece of skin hanging from his nose.
The photo didn't show that, Your Honor. It was in the exhibits. It just showed a deep laceration. The medical report also pointed out there was no perforation, which was contrary to the claim of the deputy. It didn't pierce the nasal wall. It just cut the surface of the skin. This was a heavily debatable issue that I think could have been better well or more informed and it more illustrated if the doctor had been called, because the door swings both ways. I can't stand here and say that calling the doctor would have given Mr. Beaulieu's attorney his way to negate that element. It would have given the state more ability to confirm. For all we know, the doctor would have come in and herself described it as a serious disfiguring injury. Nobody ever did except the unqualified deputy and the totally unqualified records supervisor, who was allowed, with no knowledge of how these records were compiled, to read a report talking about a laceration, fracture, deviated septum, and no ability to cross-examine her on that. My position, Judge, is that not every cut is substantial bodily harm, and with the prosecutor acknowledging during his direct of KK that you can barely see it, it's hard to see. That is not disfigurement. It is not. A visible lasting scar is. That's my position. I would move to the confrontation element here because that was also challenged at the district court. And I realize in order to do that, I have to establish that the report would have been testimonial. So I did address that. I'm relying chiefly on the Johnson case from 2008. Where the scenario is practically identical. The report was prepared 33 hours after the defendant's arrest and the investigation began. Here it was 32 hours. The test from Anderson, on which respondent has relied, is that they used the same standard of whether the report was prepared long after the investigation began. It didn't rely exclusively on whether the report repairer knew that she was doing it for the police or knew that she was doing it for trial. It was just that it was based on the input given, how the injury was received, that the doctor would have reason to know that this could be used in litigation. So it is not a strict standard that it has to be directly cited in the report. Pursuant to police investigation, I conducted an examination of this patient. Or the rest of the cases are about forensic evidence, which I suppose a medical exam is.
Well, I think my thought is the medical exam was for the purpose of treating him and therefore not prepared for the purposes of litigation. So yes. Why is that not accurate?
Well, I'm relying on this review standard, I guess, from both Johnson and Anderson about the duration, the amount of time after the police investigation began that the report, you know, when the report was prepared, and whether the doctor or the preparer would have reason to know it would be used in litigation. So the doctor
so
would
the
have been...
So the timing is just one piece that we look at, right, though? It's not completely determinative.
Yes, I okay. must agree with that. But this is also a situation where this patient was brought in many hours later, and the information the doctor would have received was that he was injured in an assault. Now, I know the doctor didn't put that words in there, but if somebody is going to be treated, the examining physician is going to ask how this happened. And that may also explain why the doctor felt the need to put in there, or maybe it would have been standard practice, that the fracture in the deviated septum looked like they could have been old. It seemed like she was trying to discriminate between what had just occurred and what might not have. I mean, that is an identifiably, litigatory issue right there. I think if this person had been brought in before anybody knew what happened, the doctor would probably just focus on the nature of the injury and how severe it was. But I don't know that. I'm just suggesting that the time after the incident that the report is prepared should be deemed significant here in order to find this testimonial. But as to the effect, I mean, the chief harm, of course, is the denial of the fundamental Sixth Amendment right in not being able to examine the doctor. You know, the harm is, again, the disputed origin that Mr. Beaulieu could not cross-examine on the fracture and deviated septum, which the prosecutor focused exclusively on in closing argument. The only effective way the defendant could have countered this evidence was to cross-examine the doctor.
I'm getting... Mr. Havili, I wonder if you could go to the video issue.
Yes.
Because, I mean, there was, unlike some other cases, I mean, there was some redaction. So the question is, how much more could have been redacted without removing all the probative value based on some of the admissions your client made in the video?
Your Honor, I'm glad you asked that. I think I specifically detailed in my brief the only thing the prosecutor redacted was reference to a prior arrest or probation. That was it. He then said that he felt everything else was relevant. And I detailed in my brief how extensive the inflammatory material was. I'm relying on Big Bear for that, where I know they ultimately didn't find grounds to reverse, but that's because the situation was different. In Big Bear, the evidence was elicited, but the prosecutor never mentioned it again. Here in closing, the prosecutor went right to it and told the jury to consider how he treated that deputy. I mean, by saying that, that is persuasion by illegitimate means, the very definition of irrelevant evidence, leaving aside the question of how inflammatory it was. I noted there was a 15-page transcript and that the last four pages of it was virtually filled with these racial and other denigrating epithets. Old Chief, I'm relying on for talking about how bad character evidence has persuasive effect on a jury. So those were the main points that I wanted to make about how, I should add a third. I do go through in my brief, this case was a total mess. All the witnesses were saying different things. The most notable thing to me was that one of the non-interested parties, CT, who arrived after whatever was happening was in progress. See, she testified that KK and that KK's son and Mr. Beaulieu were already fighting outside the truck. She said she found KK asleep, which totally contradicts the testimony of KK's sons that not only the struggle, but the cut happened inside the truck. Then there was another son, the other testimony of the son was that he only saw Mr. Beaulieu with a stick in his hand. So the jury had to make some very hard credibility determinations, which is their exclusive province. The argument here is that they were given the means to decide that those questions through illegitimate bad character evidence. Everything in this case turned on credibility. Mr. Beaulieu raised self-defense. I realized that his statements caught on tape were definitely challengeable, but he got on the stand to his credit and tried to defend them. It was either him or the other witnesses. So with the other witnesses providing the starkly differing accounts, my argument is that this video made the difference, and I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Maravilla. You will have a rebuttal. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, my name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota. I think the most important fact to keep in mind is that the victim had surgery where doctors used 8 stitches to repair a wound to his nostril. 8 stitches by itself sounds like a lot, but then when you compare to how small your nostril is, they had to cram 8 stitches into a relatively small amount of real estate, which is indicative of how serious this injury was. So turning first to appellant sufficiency of the evidence claim, when you read the reply brief, you come away with the impression that the state has the burden of convincing you that the jury got it right. That's exactly wrong. He has the burden of convincing you that the jury got it wrong, and he's got a heavy burden. I don't have to cite to precedential case law. I can cite to non-precedential cases that are persuasive and apply very similar facts, and that's enough for me to defeat his argument. I don't have to provide any more. He has to convince you, not the other way around. As for the challenge to the squad video, his argument below was that, and he made this argument while they were waiting for jury selection. And his concern was, this video is going to be so inflammatory, we're going to have a predominantly white jury, and this is so inflammatory that it's going to result in a jury that is inflamed and prejudicial against him. Well, as I point out, this jury was not unfairly inflamed against him because they found him not guilty of the most serious charge. Now, in his reply brief, appellant refers to that argument as absurd, but I don't think there's anything absurd about it. If you're claiming that this was so inflammatory that it was going to bias the jury against me, and then the jury goes ahead and acquits you of the most serious count, I think that does away with that argument. Also
at trial below, did trial counsel argue once the court had made the decision not to exclude the entire video, did trial counsel make an argument, well, then you need to redact, you know, all of these prejudicial and offensive statements? Was that argument made?
No, and I was going to point out
that it was all or nothing.
Yes, it was all or nothing, and tucked away on page 13 of the reply brief is a statement that the district court abdicated its responsibility to redact the most inflammatory portions, but that request was never made, so it's plain error standard of review here, and that plain error argument where he carries the burden is not fleshed out. As for the challenges to the medical record, this is a running objection that spans several pages. And when he makes the initial objection, trial counsel doesn't seem to understand that the medical records exception applies to diagnoses. That has to be pointed out to him. From that point on, he doesn't have any objection. The district court judge says, I'm finding that Ms. Friesen qualifies to testify on this. He makes other arguments, but he doesn't make any argument on that point. But you can put that all aside, because under the harmless error standard, he simply doesn't entitled to relief. There's a standard of review that is deferential to a district court's evidentiary determinations, and this court does not lightly overturn them. So under the harmless error, he's not entitled to a new trial. And then with the confrontation clause, yes, he cites to Johnson, but Anderson distinguishes Johnson. That involved a medical examiner who's performing an autopsy. Obviously, that's going to have impact in litigation. But most ER docs, when they're dealing with injuries, when people come in to see them from midnight to 6 o'clock in the morning, how many of those are going to involve possibly some form of charges? Probably a fair number of them. Knifings, stabbings, even car crashes. There could be questions of litigation farther down the road. But they're just there to treat people. That's what they do. That's what the court found in Anderson. Dr. Binder, in that case, he's just treating a patient that appears in front of him. The report that is prepared is not testimonial. It's prepared as part of the doctor's function is of treating the patient. That's exactly what happened here. It was not testimonial, therefore the confrontation clause doesn't come into play, but even if it does.
How do you respond to the concern raised about the timing then, that we should be giving more weight to that in the situation like this, where the examination occurred after charges clearly were being contemplated?
Well, Anderson addresses that in the last page and a half. It says even if criminal case was charged, was started before the medical exam or the medical doctor is seen. What we look at is the purpose of it. What was this person doing? Unlike a medical examiner, unlike in Caulfield, where you're sending a sample to a BCA analyst, they know that's what they're doing. But there's no evidence that the doctor knew that there had been any criminal charges taking place, and that's what we're looking at. Sure, the victim knew that, but is there evidence that the doctor knew that? Even if the doctor knew that, it wouldn't change it, but there's no evidence that the doctor knew that and that somehow tainted his report and turned this into a testimonial document. If there are other questions, I'll entertain them. Otherwise, I just ask the court to apply the appropriate standards of review and affirm.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Maravilla, you'll have the last word, sir.
Well, I would like, if I may, to address mainly the nature of the objection to the video that was asked. I've gone directly to the portion of the trial record where defense counsel did begin by saying that he did not expect the state was even going to use them. But his objections to them were specific about what was irrelevant and inadmissible, all of the inflammatory language. So while there may not have been an actual redaction request, I guess my response to that would have to be that the objection was made to the specific contents that he did say were irrelevant. That would be the proper objection. The judge should have or could have decided that that portion of the videotape was inadmissible on that basis, and the duty for seeing the need for or completing redaction, you know, is on the state. It's not really up to the defendant to explain that, you know, what the remedy is. He was identifying the harm. So I don't see how that objection would not have been preserved properly. I think defense counsel was very specific, and this
was
on.
Are there times when it's impractical to redact a portion? you know, I watched the video, I listened to, I read the transcript, something like 50% of it is expletives, but, you know, interspersed in between those spaces are those, like, snippets of probative information. So how do we deal with that?
Well, I believe at one point during his arguments, defense counsel pointed out how, you know, at one point he's just going on and on. So I reviewed it as well, and that's literally the last four pages of the transcript. So it wouldn't have been unwieldy or cumbersome for the state just to remove those last four pages. Mr. Beaulieu had already made his claims about being cut, about who started it, about everything else. I think that has to be contrasted with the claim by the prosecutor, where he said that taking out the part related to probation or whatever the prior offense was, he felt everything else was relevant. Well, it wasn't. And if anything, defense counsel was responding to that specific argument that it was all relevant. He pointed out what was irrelevant. So to me, it seems that, you know, everybody in the court having listened to that tape, it would be pretty evident that the entire last section was just Mr. Beaulieu going into a very disturbing and, you know, frankly, very unpleasant volley of words directed at this deputy. You know, which again, I'll add, the prosecutor told the jury to think about during his closing argument. So, with or without the reference to redaction, it would not have been difficult to identify the largest portion of this where the inappropriate character evidence was contained.
Counsel, I wanted to ask you about the your second agreement about the sufficiency of the evidence.
Yes.
Argument. You suggest that we should be using a circumstantial
review,
and I'm wondering why that is, because there's testimony and photos as well as the medical record. Why isn't that direct evidence of the substantial bodily harm?
It is direct evidence that there was an injury and even a way to assess its severity. But I'm relying on the Supreme Court Rhodes decision from 2003, where they specifically stated that a medical report is circumstantial evidence on both the cause and ultimately the severity of the injuries. I don't have that cite with me, but it's in my brief. Additionally, I think the prosecutor himself wound up teeing it up as circumstantial, because when he was examining KK, he just said, well, I guess it's hard to see where the injury is on your nose. So as far as the severity of the harm, the jury had to decide what was the most, you know, reasonable inference to draw from the evidence. Was this temporary and substantial disfigurement or not disfigurement at all? And given the equivocal nature of the medical report in this case, I think it can only fairly be characterized as circumstantial. And especially on the question of when this fracture and deviated septum happened. You know, if the doctor had come in and testified about it, we probably wouldn't have an issue of it, whether it was circumstantial. She might have chosen to give a definitive opinion. That never happened. And I see I'm already out of time. If nothing else, thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. The matter is submitted. We will be issuing our decision in 90 days. That being our last argument of the day, we are adjourned. It was nice to see you again, Mr. Maravilli.
Likewise, Your Honor.
All rise.